gonna shine when the light grows dim. Sing 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 2, 1. Cause no one can do it like we do it, like we do it, like we do it. Cause no one can do it like we do it, like we do it, like we do it. Hello.
Oh, hello.
I'm Cass.
I'm Emma.
This is Honey Do Me Podcast.
Mm-hmm. Even though it sounds like your name, it's not just
it's
yours.
It's not. It's both of us.
Yeah.
And what do we talk about here on Honey Do Me?
Having sex.
Getting loving on.
Relationships. Yeah.
Confidence.
And just having a good time.
We are all about.
We just want to be happy to be here.
Yeah.
In life, and here I mean the world.
The world.
That's the community we're trying to build here.
Yeah.
So welcome.
Welcome.
I have an update.
Yes, you do.
I am wearing a sweater set.
A lovely one at that.
Thank you. But for tops that I wear over tank tops, from now on, they will be called my cover top.
Oh, how cute.
There's a TikToker, and they do get ready with me's, and they always wear a brooch and a cover top.
Where's your brooch?
You know, when my sister started sending me these get ready with me's with this TikToker, I was like, whatever fucking happened to brooches, man? Like, why don't we still wear?
We should hit up G Will.
But Gabby, my roommate, was like, I don't think nothing happened to them. Mm-hmm. People just don't start wearing them usually until they're older.
Yes.
I want to bring that back. And this TikToker, whose name I'm now forgetting, they started it.
Bring the fuck back. You should get a crystal vagina brooch. Or vulva brooch.
Just labia.
Yeah.
I want crystal labia, crystal penis. Imagine, have you seen the other TikTokers that do like condom earrings?
Yes.
Those are fucking cool.
Those are fun. I love them.
We should get them.
We absolutely
They made
should.
A Valentine's Day ones.
I saw those. I loved them so much. I stared at them for so long. They were so glossy.
So glossy.
And I love that transition because... condoms could be the cover top of the penis.
Yes, correct. That is the penis cover top.
But no brooch.
No brooch. Ouch.
Stabby. Unless you like it that way, that's really your business.
Yeah, that's really your business. I guess a brooch, what would be considered a brooch for a penis? Like a cock ring?
A sticker? Oh.
Two different ways.
Both valid.
Yeah.
Both valid.
That's not even kind of what we're talking about today, though.
No, but brooches are quite the beautiful transition because other things that happen when we're older, our hormones change. And I feel like hormones are very widely talked about right now. We're all about balancing our hormones, understanding our hormones, and like, get it. Get your shit on. But a lot of shit's going to happen, and it's going to happen a lot sooner than you think. Today we're talking menopause. Don't turn around.
The episode. Come back.
Yes. Come right back. Give us a chance.
Did you know that you should have started thinking about... Okay, you didn't... there's no shoulds. I'm not going to should you. But you could have been thinking...
You're just shooting all over them.
I'm shooting all over them. Menopause is like a complete reflection of when we got our first periods.
So, it's our last.
And it's our last. But I didn't realize how much... Because we were talking like... Okay, what do we need to do? And there's still things that we can do in our 20s and our 30s, whatever, to prepare for this hormonal shift. But also a lot is predetermined from like puberty.
You're born with it, baby.
And what that says, like when you hit puberty, what that says about how your hormones will change throughout the rest of your life and the type of sex you're going to be having.
Yes.
The quality of life you're going to be having as you get older and your hormones change and what's happening now. I mean... It was kind of mind-blowing.
Absolutely. It is such a mind-blowing episode. And we know that menopause doesn't sound like the sexiest topic to talk about, but this is the thing that, like, this is the kind of information that we need to know now because we talk about now all of the things that we should have learned in high school. Like, we should have learned how to do that. We should have learned how to do this. This is what we need to be learning in our 20s and 30s so that when our 40s come, 40s, we're fucking ready.
Like how they should have taught about... credit cards and bank statements in high school.
Exactly.
Because why are you learning about it when you're already going through it?
Yes.
That's terrifying.
Exactly.
What symptoms to look for? All that shit, man.
you should not be learning about menopause as you're going through it.
And also, what does that say about like how we talk about our own bodies in our own phases? If there's like a lot of shame wrapped up in phasing out of what would be
your childbearing years,
you know, and what, I don't know. So I think it's all very interesting. And the fact that we haven't talked enough about it says a lot about sex ed and how we view our bodies and all that stuff.
Absolutely. So we have Dr. Shama on the podcast. She is
dynamite.
A stunner. Love her. And she answers every question and explains all of it. She's a professional menopauser doctor.
No better intro than that, my guy.
You're welcome, Dr. Shama.
Softball this over to Dr. Shama.
And we'll see you on the other side.
I am Shama Matthews. I am a board-certified OBGYN. I focus on minimally invasive GYN surgery and general gynecology. So most of my practice is built out of patients who are seeking care outside of pregnancy. So that might be adolescent care or menopause care or chronic pelvic pain care, all of those kinds of things related to GYN. And then I also do GYN surgery, so robotics and laparoscopic surgery, minimally invasive surgery for benign, like so non-cancer GYN concerns. I practice in central New Jersey. I trained in New York. And I'm also a medical advisor for Playground, which is a women's personal lubricant company. And I'm personally very excited about it because it's women run, women focused. And that's something that's pretty unique in this particular industry.
Absolutely. Well, we're so excited to have you. And we're excited to approach this topic with you and get some perspective and knowledge because it's a topic that we've never really been taught about, and that's menopause. So could you first start with explaining what menopause is?
Sure. So menopause is interesting because it's a retroactive diagnosis. So you diagnose menopause when a woman has gone one full year without having a period. And that's not having a period for other causes. Meaning like other hormonal concerns, other medical issues that could cause missing a period for a long time. But when you just miss a period and everything else is normal for one full year, that's what we call menopause.
Okay. And does that happen at a specific time in our lives?
Yes.
Like what time
yes.
is that?
So what would be considered a normal time would be sort of after the age of 45. The average age is 51, plus minus a few years, obviously. And then there's also an interesting case called perimenopause. And that is literally the entire time leading up to menopause when our hormones are fluctuating. So that could be anywhere near 5 to 7 years before you actually reach menopause, you could be going through perimenopause. So you could be having all the symptoms of menopause, but not quite missing a full year's worth of a period. And that is all of perimenopause. So that can be pretty distressing because a woman doesn't quite know what's happening. Mm-hmm. A lot of changes can be going on all over the body. And without really kind of knowing what's happening, it can be difficult to approach. I've had women go to multiple specialists before someone even suggested, hey, is this hormone related? Like, could it be menopause? So that's an interesting phase as well.
That is a lot younger than I thought you were going to say. Uh-huh. I don't know why in my head I'm like, yeah, 70s. that must be it.
That must be the time.
We are a lot closer than
don't
I thought we were.
Yeah.
Than I thought. Not yeah. like...
We are coming up on 45, you and I.
Not quite.
So can you...
We're all coming up on 45, yeah. right? Yeah. Like 45 is just around the bend for like everyone. Yeah. And you're right. I think that's part of the problem because no one feels like they're almost 45. Like it just springs on you. So that's the thing. Like it really does sneak up on you. And there are things that you can do to sort of prepare or be mindful of what's happening to your body.
I definitely want to get into all those things. I'm wondering if we can talk about the symptoms a little bit more mm-hmm. first to get a better understanding of what happens during or
sure.
after menopause. Is menopause just like you, that's like your last like you stop having a period? Does it encompass like that last part of your life? Is it just a stage that you go through?
So the phase is actually missing that period for a full year. And then after that point, you are post-menopause. So that's the rest of your life, right? So whatever age that may be. Mm-hmm. And then the symptoms can start. That's where that symptoms kind of comes like before and after that point, that like 1 year phase where like you like miss that period for a whole year. All of the symptoms can kind of start up way before that. Actually, when you're still having regular periods, you could still start noticing some of these symptoms. And they may actually continue after you stop having your last period as well. So after that 1 year, like it's not like, oh, everything gets better. Unfortunately, those things can kind of linger on for some time as well. And there's different characteristics, like they're starting to study that a little bit more as far as like, okay, women who start menopause earlier, like how long do they go through menopause versus women who start menopause later, et cetera, how it relates to like when you first get your period, if you've had children or not, like all these different kinds of aspects. They're studying that now and starting to get more and more data on that. But really the symptoms are, they're actually quite varied. The sort of top ones that people notice would be like hot flashes, right? So really feeling, and women kind of describe it as this like central sort of burning, like hot, like central, like heating up that kind of like flushes them up like and down. And so they kind of feel like there's like a little furnace like running in me. That's how they describe it. So like these hot flashes, night sweats, waking up at night, like completely drenched, like you're sweating at night despite the temperature. Mood changes, irritability, like the PMS thing kind of going out of whack, even though like you might've been fine for years. Some women describe it kind of feeling like a teenager again, like your hormones are sort of like out of whack. This is happening. So, you know, your moods are up and down, your breasts feel tender more than often, like you feel bloated more than often, your skin is weird, all of a sudden you're having like acne, like that you haven't had in like 20 years. So, you know, those kinds of things start happening. There's sleep disturbances, you're waking up at night, like not quite understanding, like you're not sleeping a full night anymore. It's tossing and turning, those kinds of things. So there's a varied approach. There's a variety of symptoms that are quite strange as well. Feeling cold, heart palpitations, tingly fingers, like there's all sorts of other stuff that's sort of rare, but people notice. And then we kind of put back together with all of the other things that are going on and kind of trace it back to hormone changes.
Damn. Well, I don't want to shit on all that because I know that that's not the end of your life. But also I have a question. Why, it might sound very like elementary of a question, but why do we go through menopause? What is happening in our bodies that makes us have our last period?
So basically, you know, our reproductive organs are only functional for a certain amount of time. We only have a certain amount of eggs to release every month with the goal of fertility, right? Like that's unfortunately what we're built for. And then at the end of that, when that sort of is dwindling, it's almost like a way for the body to not spend resources on something that is no longer viable, right? Like it's no longer a goal. It's not primary. It's not sustaining the purpose anymore. So that's what it is. It's basically the end of that being the primary goal and function of our bodies. So our hormones, which they pick up the cycle. And so we have a normal, quote unquote, normal, everyone's normal is a little different, but like whatever it is, cycle for this period of time where we are, you know, reproductive age or fertile, right? Like during that time. And then when that dwindles, you start having sort of changes in that cycle. It's no longer a cycle. The hormone levels sort of fluctuate. They're not quite as regular. They're sort of trying to figure themselves out. They're not getting the right prompts. They're not being sort of signaled the same way. And it's that start of no longer needing that function. So that's where that happens. But, you know, a lot has changed and we live a lot longer beyond menopause, and we still have lives, very functional and full lives after menopause. So a lot of what we're talking about these days are how do we make that life still as robust and great and full as the rest of our lives? Like, because our primary goal and purpose now in this time and era is not fertility, right? Like it's just being, like it's our being. So how do we make our being and our personhood full beyond menopause?
Got it. This may be a really specific question, and I don't know if other people are interested, but I am, and this is, I'm doing
this. It's your podcast.
It's my podcast. What is actually happening with the hormones? Like, which ones are going up and which ones are going down? Like, what hormones are causing all of this?
So estrogen and progesterone are the estrogen and progesterone are the prime figures in our hormone management, right? There's also testosterone, there's cortisol, there's all these other things as well, but like, those are the two sort of GYN hormones. That's what's regulating our cycles. Our, when do we ovulate? Is our uterine lining building? When do we have a period? All of those things. So those hormones are going down, but it's not as clean cut as that. It's not like it's just sort of like, you know, straight slope down. It's actually quite erratic in the years leading up to it. And so that's what brings on all these like different symptoms. It has to do with the fact that it's quite erratic and it's up and down and unpredictable in those years before it sort of dwindles down to below the mark that induces a period.
Okay. And what happens to your uterus once you are like post-menopausal? Like, does it stay? What happens? I imagine it doesn't like fall out. Okay. Does it like just shrink it all? I don't know.
Like a raven, it falls into the
like,
ashes.
I don't know, just like less nutrients go to it? I don't know.
That's actually a pretty good question. No, the uterus kind of hangs out. The ovaries do shrink, actually. They get a little bit smaller because they're no longer, you know, producing eggs. They're not ovulating. Mm-hmm. They don't need to like develop follicles. So they're, you know, kind of fuller and more robust like during our fertile years because they're constantly being sort of stimulated. And afterwards they do kind of shrink. They don't disappear normally. They do get quite smaller. The uterus itself stays about the same size, maybe a little bit smaller. I don't know that we've had like real comparisons. Women who have findings in the uterus, like things like fibroids, for example, their fibroids do get a little bit smaller. So things like that do, you're right, because they're driven by hormone and they're no longer being stimulated, that kind of, you know, sort of, you know, shrinks down a little bit.
So we're not like carrying around a dead organ. It's like,
and then can we go through menopause and still have eggs in our ovaries, or are all our eggs gone by the time we're hitting menopause?
It's not that all of the eggs are gone, they're just not being released because they're not being triggered. But then typically by that point, most of our eggs are also not necessarily in the best shape.
Right, because they start to wither, right?
That we have. Right. Yeah, so we're born with all the eggs we have, and then we actually lose a significant amount of them before we even reach like puberty. And then we lose, it's not like we lose one every time we ovulate. We actually lose a certain amount, like, you know, kind of throughout the time. And then when we reach the point of menopause, it's not that they're all spent, it's just that they're not being stimulated anymore. But also at that point, we worry a little bit about the quality of the eggs because they kind of probably changed a little bit over time. Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
So interesting.
It is so interesting.
Are there any good things that happen during menopause?
After menopause, you can't get pregnant.
There you go.
So that's a plus. You can totally have fun and not have to worry about like getting knocked up. So that's kind of a fun thing. You can kind of create that as sort of a bit of a sexual liberty in some ways, right? Mm-hmm. There are changes that happen to our body, but it's about responding to them, about sort of anticipating them. What can you do to aid that change to make it not cumbersome or problematic, but, you know, kind of embrace it. So those would be sort of like the good positives kind of thing that happens. Mm-hmm.
It definitely sounds scary. And I feel like the only way I've ever heard menopause talked about is in a very like scary way, or like people going through menopause and talking about how much it sucks.
Or like just in the same way that, you know, periods get joked about. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, you're on your period. That's why you're being a bitch. Mm-hmm. Or like going through menopause. And this is like my dark years of being so unpredictable and, you know, intolerable. Also,
I know. I agree with you. And actually, I think for a long time, women have been sort of gaslighted that that like is normal and they should just put up with it and stop bitching about it. Like, fine, it's just your place as being a woman. Oh, it's your age. Well, it's menopause. Deal with it.
Right.
And I think that's sort of the big thing for me is like, you don't have to suffer. There, we have a lot of solutions and a lot of options. It's just a matter of like, one, being educated and seeking out someone that's going to, you know, open that world to you, open those options to you and not just tell you, oh, put up with it, like deal with it, stop complaining.
Right.
So whether it is, you know, hormonal or non-hormonal or supplements or acupuncture or mindfulness and, you know, meditation, all of these things, there's been studies that actually looked at how all of these things affect your experience through menopause, and it can be completely manageable and completely, you know, navigated in a way that it is, doesn't have to be this like falling off a cliff, terrible experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That makes me think about in college, we were both in like sociology, anthropology, and I learned a lot about how different interpretations of like birth impact your experience of birth. So like people in different countries have very different experiences with birth and like pain level and all of that. And I've never birthed a child, so I can't speak specifically to that, but I think it's super interesting how your like the social context around something impacts the experience of it so drastically.
Right.
Yeah, I can completely understand that, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you approach something already with an inbuilt fear of it, right, dread of it, you're going to approach it differently than knowing it's something that you can tackle, you can handle, as long as you have the right tools.
Mm-hmm. So Cass and I have both had issues with finding healthcare providers that have, one, listened to us completely, and two, offered solutions that aren't just putting us on medication, whether it's our period, our cramps. Mine used to be like around sex and not feeling like a sex drive anymore. So with menopause, what is important in finding a doctor that's going to help you find like solutions that are wide and open and not just like, oh, sucks, this is kind of what you're going through, you know? Yeah. Like, how do we find a caregiver that can help
care provider that I help? Practice in Jersey, in, you know, sort of Northern America. So there's the North American Menopause Society is an incredibly good resource. One, as far as something that you could go to the website, and they have patient resources as well as far as what to expect. And then there's also a database of providers who are certified under the North American Menopause Society. So I'm a certified provider, which means I went through an exam and I have to keep up my credits by taking a certain number of classes or courses or attending their conference on menopause specific content every 2 years. So it's actually pretty stringent. Mm-hmm. So that's a great resource in the North American countries. And then the European Society, there's a similar kind of mimic mirror European Society, which is amazing as well. Both conduct great research on the topic as well. And then they publish those studies in their publications, and then also present them available to patients to reference. So that's a great place to start, I would say.
Mm-hmm. That's a great resource, definitely, and awesome that you kind of get like a checkup every 2 years and you're staying current with things that are coming up and maybe new solutions that can help different people. I wish we had doctors before that, you know, had to do that as well.
I agree. And I will say, just having recently kind of completed their recertification this past year, their conferences do include things that aren't medication focused. Like what's the latest on supplements? What's the latest on non-hormonal options and therapeutics as far as like, how do they work? What are the studies? Unfortunately, the studies aren't that great. And that's really the bottom line for a lot of things, because they're a little bit hard to study. But they do present what's available. And then again, you're dealing with practitioners who are sort of focused on this. So then they have a huge patient base and even their personal experience as far as, you know what, I know the study doesn't necessarily say that this is the case, but I have had patients that's worked for. So why don't you try it? Let's give it that an opportunity and you an opportunity to try that before we go on to other things. So we can still kind of work with patients with what's important to them, what are their goals, what are they trying to achieve, without necessarily being like, well, this is the only route, or saying that, you know, well, there's nothing to do.
Mm-hmm. What kind of medications and supplements are generally prescribed or used, as well as like what lifestyle changes, I guess, are generally
that's a topic in itself, right? So how do you manage menopause? Like, what are the mm-hmm. things you can do? So I'll start with some basic stuff. One, awareness. So even just like what you were talking about from that sociology aspect of like knowing what you're going through and sort of acknowledging it and knowing that that's what's happening, the mindfulness surrounding that, there's actually been good studies about how cognitive behavioral therapy and mindfulness and meditation actually help. Patients who have frequent or very intense hot flashes, when they start using mindfulness techniques, their hot flashes reduce in number and in intensity, right? Wow. Like, so you sort of acknowledge the fact that that's what's happening, and that helps you bring it down, as opposed to bringing it into like a panic mode where you're like, oh my God, I'm like flustered, and it's escalating because you're not meeting it and acknowledging it and bringing it down, right? Like that mindfulness technique aspect of it. So there's good studies on that. So that's like, I mean, that's not easy, mm-hmm. but it is a very, validating kind of thing to tell patients as well, right? Like when you sort of name it and you tell them what they're going through and you teach them what they're going through, like the fact that they can identify it and then not feel so scared or vulnerable in the situation and control that, you know, for themselves is really important. And then as far as supplements, there are quite a few available. There's tons marketed. I honestly, patients will be like, oh, I read this or this popped up on my Instagram. Like, would this be helpful? And honestly, I have to be honest. I was like, I don't know everything that's out there, but you know, there are some things that we know. Evening primrose oil, black cohosh, ashwagandha. Like there's different things that people have looked at as far as supplements that kind of help balance them. What I'll say is most of the studies have been sort of up or down, like not really conclusive, but that's the same thing I'll tell my patients is that I've had patients that say that worked. It turned them around. It really helped them. So it's not a bad thing to try. You do have to give it enough time. Most of those things aren't going to happen right off the bat. Like you have to usually use them for several weeks. Some things actually can kind of make things a little bit worse for some patients. Just your bodies are different and your chemistry is different. So you have to take that with a grain of salt. The same thing can be said for acupressure, acupuncture, those kinds of methods as well. Same thing. I've had lots of patients that has really helped them, and others that felt like that kind of, you know, provoked some of their symptoms. So it's a worthwhile endeavor, but you kind of have to go into it the same way with an open mind. As far as prescription medications, there's hormone replacement therapy, which got a really bad rep because of a lot of media surrounding this one study that happened in the 80s. And then since then, tons of studies have happened, and actually extension studies from that initial study happened. And we've really come to a better understanding of hormone replacement therapy, where we actually can say very confidently for most women who don't have risk factors, hormone replacement therapy can actually be very beneficial in the initial years of menopause. It can help them through the worst of the worst and also continue to protect their heart and bones in those initial years, right? Like we can safely say that. Now, then there's a lot of caveats. Are you a safe patient? Do you have risk factors? How long are you going to be using it? You know, are we extending this into later years? Like, so there's all these other aspects of it, but we really need to get away from being so negative about hormone replacement therapy, because just like any other medication, everything comes with potential risks. It just depends if you are the right fit for that, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just a matter of figuring that out. And then I'll even say that there's a non-hormonal. So for the patients who really can't take hormones because they have risk factors or they're really like not comfortable with that as an option, there is an entire segment of medications. So there, this is actually another kind of tricky topic because there are medications that you usually use for antidepression or anti-anxiety, which comes with its own stigmas. But there's tons of studies that show that it works for menopausal symptoms. So it really reduces hot flashes. It helps with sleep. It helps with anxiety, all of these other things that you might be dealing with in menopause. But some people get a little anxious about it. I was like, well, because I don't want to be on something that I'm not depressed. I'm not anxious. I don't want to be on a psychiatric medication. It's like, no. You have to understand that we're using it for a different purpose, but it does tie into that. And that's not actually that far-fetched because we know our hormones and our brain neurotransmitter and functions do interact, right? Like we have so many examples of that. PMS, PMDD, postpartum depression, like all these other things that happen because of hormone fluctuations. So there's an entire category of medications that focus on that.
It is so interesting to me that like hormone replacement therapy and hormonal birth control, we've been talking about this. Mm-hmm. Like we had an episode on it a little while ago. And just things that typically help people with uteruses are so demonized. And then when we don't use them, we experience a lot of really shitty symptoms. Mm-hmm. But like, do we talk shit about erectile dysfunction medication? Like, I have not heard a lot of rhetoric around, like, well, that's really bad for your body. Mm-hmm. Like, right. I don't think I've heard anything ever.
Could you give a brief overview of what hormone replacement therapy is? Because I've definitely heard of it, and until you mentioned it just now, it completely slipped my mind as a thing.
Yeah. So it's interesting because we talk about birth control all the time, right? Like, we take that for 20, 30 years of our life without ever questioning it. It's a combination of estrogen and progesterone that prevents pregnancy. That's what contraception is. That's what hormone contraception is typically. Hormone replacement therapy is a combination of estrogen and progesterone. Mm-hmm. That's basically all it is. It's a different formulation. It's a different balance of amount of hormone. It's usually in a slightly different method. It's not usually just one pill. It's usually a pill and a patch or a pill and a topical. There are combined pills. There's a lot of different methods. There are also lots of different doses. There are typically in a lower range of hormones than even birth control pills. So it's kind of interesting that they, like, one gets, you know, you're right, both get kind of demonized in some ways, but like one gets such a stigma and the other one is sort of like accepted as part of, you know, our usual life. People take it and do it. But then you get like real, you know, people get really heated about like, oh my God, you're on hormone replacement therapy, you're going to get breast cancer. It's like, okay, well, you know, that's not necessarily
right.
True.
Yeah. Okay, gotcha. So it's kind of like replenishing and balancing the fluctuations that you're going through.
Right. And it's not meant to bring your hormone level back to like a premenopausal range. Mm-hmm. I describe it to my patients as a buffer. Like as far as things going up and down, it's trying to buffer that change and like buffer that loss. So it's a little bit more manageable. You're just trying to cushion that. So it's not so dramatic for what your body's experiencing.
And you said it varies, but how long do people tend to be on hormone replacement therapy if that's what they choose to do?
Everyone's different. I would say the most problematic time is probably in the first sort of 5 years surrounding menopause. 5 to 7 is what they describe. I've had some women go on it for much longer. They've tried to come off and, you know, they experience a ton of symptoms. It's affecting their quality of life. It's affecting their relationships, all these other things that they're doing. And, you know, they opt to stay on it for a little bit longer. And again, it's one of those things where we revisit their risk factors every year. We make sure that it's a safe thing to continue. We try to come down to the lowest dose possible. We might try some alternatives along the way. So it's an active conversation and it's very individualized.
So many options out there, which is so relieving for different avenues you can take to relieve these symptoms. So that's great to hear. Do we want to get into how we can like prepare?
Yes.
As mid to late 20-year-olds or 30-year-olds. So what can we be doing in our life right now to prepare for menopause? And is there anything we can do to make it better?
A lot of it is actually governed by your internal chemistry, genetics, you know, things you can't control, right? Like when you first got your period and when, if you had pregnancies or when your mom went through menopause because of the genetic factor, right? So there is a lot that you can't necessarily control. I would say things that you can do is being very mindful of your cycle. So whether it's tracking it through an app or really kind of understanding or paying attention to your bodies during your cycles, you know, if you are on a hormone replacement pill or for like a birth control pill, fine, just still be mindful of how your body is even on that pill, because that's not necessarily something that, you know, shuts down what's going on in our bodies. It just sort of, again, same thing, sort of buffers what's happening. So you can still experience differences and changes of, you know, breast tenderness and that breast changes, how your uterus feels. Do you feel, you know, bloating, how your moods are, vaginal dryness, pain with intercourse, all those kinds of things can still be pretty present even in our pre menopausal years. And then as we get into peri, you'll be more cognizant of those changes as things approach.
Gotcha. And is it the reason that it's important to know when we started our period, is that just because that's when, you know, we started dispersing eggs? Like, yeah. What is the importance of knowing, like, or of the first start of your period with menopause?
Yeah, because it sort of captures sort of what's our window for some women. And again, these can be varied. Some people do have longer windows and shorter windows, but it's sort of that reproductive window, like of when you start releasing eggs and all of those kinds of things, gives us a better impression of when you might start experiencing menopausal symptoms.
So can you predict then, like, by me telling you when I started my period, like, potentially
if I tell you to the minute,
kind of like my birth chart, you know, yeah. Like, if I tell you I'm a Scorpio, can you tell me when I'll go through menopause?
We are actually starting to develop, like, there's research on tests of blood tests and hormone levels that we can actually test that can give us a better evaluation of when, you know, how close we are to menopause or when we're in menopause. We're not quite there yet. And again, because people are so different, if it was a fixed thing, right? Mm-hmm. If we knew it was a fixed thing, yes, I could predict that. But because people are different and people might have a different window and there's probably different categories of this, I can't necessarily say that, right? Like, we don't have that. But those are factors that play into our our length of reproductive window, and then also the length of our menopausal transition.
Gotcha. That's fair.
So is there anything that we do that research has shown maybe makes menopause happen earlier or delays it at all? Or is that all just genetic and variable?
There's a lot of talk. There's, you know, there's a lot of, I guess, they're looking into it. There's different things that they talk about. There was actually recently, I was looking at an article that someone posted about, like, if you have more sex, does that delay menopause, right? And it was an interesting theory, and we don't have a conclusion on it at all. They looked at people that were having intercourse, whether or not they were in a relationship, like, more frequently versus less frequently, and then when do they end up reaching menopause? And it was an interesting question. And the theory behind it was that, yeah, more sex delays menopause, and they were like, it's sort of tricking your body into thinking that you're sort of still reproductive. But they don't have any conclusions on that, right? Like, so I'm not like,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Get freaky, people.
Not saying you shouldn't either, but like, I'm not going to say that that is going to necessarily influence menopause for sure. But there are a lot of questions about that. Like, what can you do and what can you do to put it off and delay it? But a lot of it is, like I said, out of our control.
Mm-hmm. Right. So is there a point, hopefully, post-menopause when, like, those symptoms, the, like, harder symptoms are gone and you're just, like, rocking through life?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people will typically get to a point where the symptoms are very minimal and manageable. Most people will. Again, the window is different. It's sort of like if you started earlier with symptoms and then you went through menopause, and then you might have a shorter window after. If your symptoms started after, some women really don't even notice that they go through menopause. Like, it's not like a big thing. That happens too. It's real.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I'll be one of those. Yeah. Everything in my life so far.
Yeah, exactly. I get some of those patients every once in a while. I was like, don't tell anyone that. Like, yeah. No one will like you if you tell them that.
It's not how you make friends.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly. So it, you know, it does eventually diminish, but I'll often tell patients things like stress can trigger those symptoms again. So it was really interesting at the start of COVID. I got a lot of calls from my perimenopausal and postmenopausal patients being like, I was fine. Like, what happened? Like, all of a sudden, everything is crazy again. I have like crazy hot flashes. I'm not sleeping. What's happening? I was like, stress is affecting you. It's affecting your body. And so, you know, that's another thing to be mindful of, that you might go through periods of time where if you're going through more stress or you're not quite feeling well or your immune system is, you know, dealing with other things, that you might notice some of these menopausal symptoms kind of creep up again. Mm-hmm. But most people do eventually kind of get to a point where they can coast.
Right. What's like the minimum amount of time that you can experience symptoms and go through menopause and then come out on the other side?
I know it won't be me. Well, you know what? Your body might actually take it as like a good thing. It's like, oh, fucking finally, yeah, these hormones are getting out of here.
Let's go. Yeah. Just take the whole thing. Maybe my uterus will
leave
shrivel.
Your body. Yeah.
She's been through enough.
Yeah. That again, it varies. Again, mm-hmm. some people don't notice any symptoms, and others, okay. I would say, you know, like they say they can, it can last anywhere from 5 to 7 years, but the intensity, the frequency, the how impactful it is on one's life. So often when I'm dealing with menopausal, perimenopausal women, like I'm talking to them, like, when, you know, do you want treatment? Do you want to do anything about this? It's me asking them, is it disrupting your life? Like, is it affecting you? Are you okay? Can you manage this? Are you okay? Or is it really messing things up? Like, is it like screwing things up with your family? Is it like making it difficult for you to work? Are you not getting enough sleep? Are you anxious and like can't function? Like, don't suffer through that. We have solutions for that. But if you're okay, if you're like, okay, yeah, I got another hot flash, da da da, we laugh it off and it's fine. You know, even if it's multiple times a day, people's personalities and people's bodies and people's approaches to all of us is very different. So, you know, it's just a matter of whether or not, again, is it disruptive? And then if it is, that's sort of what I just remind them. Listen, if it ever gets to the point where it's not manageable or disruptive, we have options. Let's talk about that.
In your work and with your patients, what's the most common like first symptom that you see that people are like, this is happening, what does this mean? And you're like, oh, that's menopause.
Probably the most common one, it varies. Sometimes hot flashes, like hot flashes, nysis, irritability, and then like missing periods or weird period patterns. My period's getting shorter, my cycle's weird, it's not like as predictable, it's, you know, spotting afterwards, whatever. It could be lots of different like period changes. Mm-hmm. The one that comes later, and we didn't talk about this yet, is about like vaginal dryness and like sexual kind of stuff too, like lower libido, or the lower libido can come earlier, but like pain with intercourse, discomfort with intercourse, like doesn't quite feel right, I don't really want to do this anymore kind of thing. That happens typically later for most patients.
We are terrible sex podcast hosts.
I know.
We did not ask
we
about
even
the sexual symptoms.
Hit on that one.
So
sexual symptoms. Let's do it now.
Yeah. With vaginal dryness, I feel like lube makes a lot of sense there. Are there other things that you can use mm-hmm. to combat that? And then with the libido, is that just like, sorry? Your libido is
no.
just going to keep going down.
So libido is complicated. Let's start there. Libido is complicated. And for women, it's extra complicated because there's so many aspects to it, right? Like if you're not feeling right, if you are anxious, if you're stressed, if you're dealing with other things, you're not going to be present. And so libido really can't kick off, right? So that there's like a whole psychologic element to it for women. And then there's also the dryness or discomfort aspect of it. If it's not something you're looking forward to, like, again, you're not going to want it. So when I talk to patients, I'll ask them, are you sexually active? Are you having any discomfort or issues with intercourse? And if they say like, oh, I'm not really, like, well, is that because it's not comfortable? Like, are you having a problem like there, like that you want to talk about? Would you like to be more active? And it's because many times they kind of put it aside. A lot of women put it aside because they're like, I don't really like it. It's not joyful. It's not enjoyable because it's uncomfortable for me. So there's all these aspects to it that you have to kind of address and kind of figure out, with people too. Like, you know, relationships change, especially even married couples, like, you know, people who've been together for a long time, like your body is changing, like, you know, how you relate, your intimacy, all of that kind of plays a role for libido as well. There are things you can do for libido. So again, hormone balancing type of stuff, testosterone plays a role. There are actually medications on the market, female Viagra type stuff that's available for patients to help promote and support their libido. A lot of people just need to know that, right? Like, again, it's one of those things that we put on the wayside. Like, we're not supposed to think about it. There's a stigma about, you know, wanting to be sexual or interested in sexuality. Like, so a lot of women don't even want to, right? Especially as you age, like, why should that matter to you anymore? Mm-hmm. It's like, well, yeah, it should always matter to you.
Because I'm breathing.
It's part of your personhood. Yeah. Again, it's part of your personhood. So like, so just about figuring out like what aspect of it is it that you need to correct. Mm-hmm. And as far as the vaginal dryness goes, the vagina is incredibly hormone dependent. It's very estrogen dependent. So when our hormone levels are dropping with menopause, that tissue changes and it's not the same. It's mm-hmm. not as, it's not producing as much moisture. It's not as elastic. It's not as tough, like the layers of tissue are not as thick. So it's more easily irritable, irritated and distressed. So all of those changes happen with the change of hormone. So yes, lubricant, first step, like make sure you're using something that's going to promote all of those things, make things a little bit more lubricated and comfortable so that there's less friction, less irritation. And then you want things that aren't going to irritate or mess up the pH balance. So that's all important about a lubricant. And then beyond that, it's about correcting the hormone amount. So there's actually tons of great data about how local vaginal estrogen is really safe, like really safe because it's so local to the vagina and it can really help that tissue be as good as it was before that loss happened. So like, again, promoting those glands, promoting that moisture, promoting that elasticity, all those things that you don't want to lose. So there are options for it. Again, it's about the comfort of talking about it. It's about wanting it. It's about addressing those needs.
Mm-hmm. How does vaginal discharge change?
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
Mm. So it changes. It can change in a lot of different ways. Typically, it decreases because there's less moisture. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So the vagina is really interesting. It's an entire microbiome. Like, it has its own environment. It has its own balance of bacteria, happy bacteria, healthy bacteria, okay bacteria, and then like yeast even, like all those things live there. They're supposed to be there. It's supposed to be, they're all supposed to be kind of in like a happy medium. Mm-hmm. And then when the estrogen changes, those things can get out of whack, like up and down, you know, sort of not be in that equilibrium anymore. The healthy sort of policing bacteria that keeps things in check often drops because the pH changes when the estrogen drops. So again, discharge goes down, but then other discharges can come up, like bacterial Aww. Infections or yeast infections.
I already
so
get enough
again,
of
it's Sorry, about correcting kid. Those things. Yeah, it's about correcting those things. So, you know, it's interesting. More women than you realize, even not ones not going through menopause, can often have pH imbalances of their vaginal microbiome. So treating that directly, whether it be by using friendly products or making sure that you're sort of trying to shift that balance back to normal. With menopause, again, the underlying problem is the change in hormone. So that's one of the things you can correct. The other thing you can correct is making sure there isn't that pH imbalance when you're using things or when naturally it's changing, you're trying to get it back up to where it wants to be, where it needs to be, like by using products that kind of promote that.
Gotcha. And when you were saying localized estrogen, what does that look like in your body? Like, what are you using to have?
It's often a cream that you insert with an applicator, typically two times a week. There's also tablets. There's also a ring that stays in there and just sort of elutes estrogen, kind of like the NuvaRing, like birth control. Yeah. There's like an estrogen ring for postmenopausal patients. There's an oral tablet as well that also promotes it. So there's all different ways that you can approach that.
Wow. I cannot believe we forgot, first of all, to ask about the sexual things. That's so many things. Mm-hmm. What would you say is the most like stigmatized through menopause? Like what isn't talked about and is felt like shameful for someone who is going through menopause?
I would say it's two things. One, the sex, mm-hmm. like the intimacy, the ability to be comfortable and enjoy sex, right? Like, because enjoying sex is supposed to be shameful to begin with, no matter what the age. And then beyond menopause, it's just like, what? Like, you know, absurd. You're whatever age and you want to still have sex and enjoy it. Like, that's crazy. So there's still that whole aspect of it. And the second part, I would say, is the mental health aspect of it. Because I think that's stigmatized no matter what, at any point in our lives. And I think particularly also around menopause in the same way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. And what is most affected with mental health through menopause?
I think it's interesting. Change? There is a connection, right? Like I mentioned before, mm-hmm. right? We know about PMS. Oh, you're bitchy, you're irritable, like whatever, your period's coming. That's real. That's not because you're just uncomfortable because you have a period. Like that's real. That's happening. Mm-hmm. So there's something happening with hormone levels and neurotransmitters in our brain. That's like a chemical issue. That happens naturally to almost all women. And then the intensity of that varies. For some people, it's more intense. So there's premenstrual dysphoric syndrome, which is PMDD, which is even beyond PMS. It's like, it's more severe. It's more severe, like depression type, anxiety type symptoms surrounding their cycle. And it's very hormonal. These patients know. They're like, I know when it's going to come because I know my period's going to start on this day. My moods are going to be this way this day. And then there's postpartum depression after having a baby and the hormone changes and things that are happening. It's not because like, whatever, things are tough afterwards about having a baby. There's clearly things mentally that are going on as well that contribute to that feeling. So the same kind of thing happens when our hormones change through menopause. So often I will, when I've talked to a patient, if it's a patient I've known for a long time who mentioned, oh yeah, I've got PMS, PMDD, I did have postpartum, whatever, like they're probably more prone to having more fluctuations in their neurotransmitters and the way that their moods are, their anxiety levels, depression levels surrounding menopause. I'll also tell patients a lot of times what it is you might have, like almost all of us have, some level of baseline anxiety, depression, just like mood stuff on a day to day, right? Like dealing with our stress, et cetera, dealing with life. But we cope, we deal, right? We figure out how we can overcome. And we manage it. When it comes to menopause and then you have all these biochemical things happening, your coping is not working as well. It's not happening as much. Something that you probably would have dealt with fine like 2 years ago, like during menopause, you can't. Like it's just not, you can't catch up. Like you can't help it. And a lot of women have to be told and like validated that that's real. Like that's not them failing. It's not them, you know, losing it, can't like hold it together. It's not them. It's not anything wrong with them. It's just, it's part of that hormonal change mm-hmm. that's influencing their coping and their ability to manage stressors. And so it's just about paying attention to that. Mm-hmm.
I imagine the people in your life also impact your mental health significantly going through menopause. I think about, like you were saying earlier, we make a lot of jokes about PMS and it's like, oh, you're so irritable, whatever, like mm-hmm. one-off jokes. Yeah. But then I think about how we talk about menopausal people and it's like, well, they're really irritable, whatever. And I think about like a mom being there and like her husband and her kids talking about how irritable she is and how it's like, mm-hmm. you can't do anything. And it's like, I think about that because like my dad and I used to talk about my mom, like she was, my mom's not going through menopause, but it's like, I don't know, I feel like we tend to gang up on moms in particular around those kinds of things. And so I think about how, like, yes, you are irritable and you are going through all of those things and it probably is impacting the people around you, but then they're like reflecting it back to you in the worst way possible. And I don't know what the solution is for that. Like, how can families and the people around you be supportive? And is there something you can say to them? Like, how do we navigate that?
That is a great question. That's an excellent point of view. I think it has to come with education. Mm-hmm. One, it has to come with, you know, mom herself just being like, hey, this is what's happening. Let me tell you, let me explain to you what's happening. I can't always control it. I need you to help me through it. If I'm having like the bad moments, like this is what's happening. But she can only do that if she's been validated herself, right? Like, so she's got to be empowered to understand what she's going through to be able to share that with her family. And then that's another reason why I feel like these things need to be less stigmatized, because yeah, it's not just about women talking to each other about it, like what we're going through. It's about our social circles, right? It's about men understanding what women are going through. And that's why, like, even young men understanding what a period is and what PMS is and all those kinds of things, what's happening to a girl to have her be and feel that way, and to not stigmatize her and like feel and like antagonize her or like, you know, be negative about what she's going through because and ganging up on her, because it's something that she can't control. It's something that's biologic. And so by educating literally generations, I think that's where we get ahead of this and where we make it like a better environment all around.
God, what a deep, dark hole that could be if you aren't even validated in what you're feeling. And then everyone around you is also saying what a bitch you are.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
because also validation starts with your doctor, too.
Mm-hmm.
So like even one step removed outside of the person going through menopause, it's like you need the practitioner to also validate like your body is doing things that are normal and natural.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these things that come with it are normal and natural.
And it's hard.
And it's hard. So what... if you could say one thing to people who haven't gone through menopause yet, so like 20s and 30s, what would that be? Like, what is one thing that we should know and take away about menopause in our 20s and 30s?
I'd say our bodies are what they are, and hormones have such an influence in it, regardless, male or female, right? But for females specifically. And that changes in such a way as you're approaching menopause. And the changes start happening internally probably earlier than we even recognize. And especially as a society that we don't talk about, that it's important to kind of educate yourself and learn those changes and be open to them and talk about them and be sort of mindful of what's happening, because that's going to make that process so much different than it was for our mothers and our grandmothers and all these other women that came before us, because that wasn't something that they were attuned to or educated about or allowed to even discuss or talk about, really, even amongst themselves, right? Like, just not stuff that you talk about even to your mom or to your aunts or like to your grandparents. Like, you just don't talk about what you're going through as a woman. Like, that is a very personal thing. It's supposed to be a very solitary thing. Mm-hmm. So I think part of it is really acknowledging that there is a community and there are women going through this. And like you mentioned, doctors that validate you and can guide you through this. And other support people that can guide you through this, and just being sort of aware of that, aware of what you're going through and then what, you know, what you can collectively find.
Right. The solitary point that you mentioned, I feel like that hits so many things with women and how their bodies can change throughout their lifetime. And it's like all of this struggle and pain and stigma and shame, whatever, it has been such a solitary struggle in some ways. And that you're told that that's how you should keep it. I mean, I remember my mom and my grandma would like whisper about menopause or whisper about like still being kind of on their period or something. And that's just what you see growing up. Mm. If you have parents that are going through periods or menopause, it's like, it's such a quiet thing that mm-hmm. if only we can make it a louder thing, hopefully yeah. it can get easier in more ways yeah. than one. Mm-hmm. So thank you. Oh,
thank
so
you
so much.
Yeah. Where can our so listeners welcome. Continue connecting with you or learning from you beyond this episode?
So my website is drmatthewsgyn.com. Same as my Instagram handle. Like I said, I post things on there that are relevant to these things. I'm happy to answer questions. I'm always happy to do talks and you know, kind of do more education. I'm also a medical advisor for Playground, which is, like I said, a very consciously made personal lubricant that kind of aids women that are going through all these kinds of things as well. So any of those venues would be a way to reach me.
Perfect. Lube is for life.
Lube is for life.
Yeah.
Life. Cover top is askew.
Oh, my cover top.
My cover top.
Where's your brooch?
I sweat through my cover top today at work.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Then you just, but it's nice because you have another shirt underneath, so you can take it off, put it over the air dryers in the bathroom.
Oh, my God. I have the funniest, really quick tangent okay. story. So
this is your body. You can, it can be a really long tangent story if you want it to be.
So in college, I tried to get a job at, I don't really remember what it's called, but it's a correctional facility down the road from our college. Mm-hmm. And so I went in for my interview, but I was terrified and because I'm just bad at being interviewed and asked questions. So I was sweating through my shirt. So I parked my car in front of this fence and I was like, okay, I'm here. I'm gonna take off my shirt in front of the air conditioner because I'm gonna dry off these sweat stains.
Yeah.
And then when I was taking the tour while I was being interviewed, they're like, and right here is the courtyard. And so I had parked in front of the courtyard
and got naked
and was like airing out my shirt, not knowing that this fence was
you were out of your car doing this?
No, I was like okay. sitting in my front seat, but like in my front seat, mm-hmm. I was just in my brr.
Tits out. Hell yeah,
airing out my shirt.
Get your tits out.
In front of the courtyard where they were all outside. And like I couldn't see in, but I'm pretty sure they could see out.
Put on a show.
I sure did. Anyway, so that's my long story with.
Did you get the job?
No.
You should have kept him out longer.
I was like,
give me one more shot. I have something to show you.
I'm coming out pantsless.
I need to go dry something.
Can I use your restroom? Mm. My pants are wet.
My panties.
My seat is wet.
My undercarriage is damp as hell.
Oh, damn. I got a swamp ass is what we used to call it in rowing. Swamp ass. Anyway,
it's
hot flashes. That's how this
yes.
relates.
There you go. That's not fair to compare hot flashes to swamp ass.
No, just me sweating a
oh.
lot.
What if swamp ass is more common in menopause?
Then I'm a frequent flyer.
Don't. To the swamp. The crocodiles know me well.
Just give out a little whistle. They're like, oh, them.
Ah,
she's here a lot.
Welcome home.
Come in.
Oh, God.
Anyway. I'm going to wrap this around. Thank you, Dr. Shama, for being on the podcast today. You're a true gem for answering all of our questions and walking us through menopause.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you to our listeners for hanging out because you did. And you made it all the way to the end of this episode.
And now you're prepped.
Yeah.
You're prepped and ready.
Prepped. I don't know why I needed this. Couldn't even see it.
Yeah. She but did a two-finger dip.
A two-finger dip. Like you would in some peanut butter.
Yeah.
Prepped. Mm.
If you loved this episode, say thank you. Out
say
loud.
Thank you.
Right now. Share this episode with somebody that could benefit from knowing this information,
yeah.
which is anybody who has a vagina or anybody who knows somebody who has a vagina.
Mm-hmm.
This is stuff we need to know.
Yeah.
Go ahead and
just remembering when you thought that a uterus shriveled up and fell out of your body.
I didn't think it fell out. I think it shriveled up.
Sorry.
If you're not using something,
yeah,
wouldn't it make more sense? It's like, okay, so fight or flight, right? When you're in fight, your energy and all of your resources go towards only your vital organs.
Yeah. I don't, but that doesn't mean that they just
shut your mouth.
You're right. Okay. You're probably right.
Anyways, head on over to Apple Podcasts to rate, review, and subscribe to Honey Do Me. If this is going to be the episode that gets you to leave a written review, go ahead and leave a peanut or peanut butter.
A peanut?
For Emma's two-finger dip.
Yes. I should make a dip now and call it Emma's two-finger dip.
That's so gross.
Super Bowl Sunday coming your way.
Emma's two-finger dip.
I have long-ass fucking nails, too.
That and the Norgasm method. Stay tuned to learn more about that. You can also rate us on Spotify, and you can email us if you want to.
Okay. If you want to talk.
We will see you next week. Bye.
Bye.